This is Dan Hill, and we're listening to IndyCan Radio.
Dan Hill, your book, the first thing that struck me is the candor in it. I mean, in songwritings, you can create characters and, you know, just sort of be as bold as you want and, you know, sort of put that self-revealing on somebody else. But this is just about you and your life, and you don't seem to candy coat anything. Was that what you were meaning to do?
Well, I wasn't really thinking about it. I was just trying to really honestly tell the story of my life and my father's life and our parallel lives, you know,
right,
before we actually obviously met, and then our lives together and the conflicts and the love and the grappling for control that we had that so many fathers and sons have. When I wrote the book, I wasn't really thinking about people reading it. You know, it's sort of like the way I write songs. I just write them, and I don't think about an audience or whether Celine Dion will like it. I'm just lost in the process of the song or the book. So I think if I was thinking, well, people may read this, it may have scared me, you know, revealing so much. But because I just said I'm going to write it, I haven't approached a publisher, I hadn't shown it to anyone, I didn't really think too much about it being candid until the day it was released. And then the book came out earlier than I thought it was supposed to come out.
You right.
know, sometimes with publishers, they'll say, this is your release date, and say that it'll say February 14th, but it's actually in the stores 2 weeks earlier.
Yeah.
So then there's this, then I got really scared. I went, oh my God, it's in the stores. It was like, luckily, I wasn't scared until it was actually in the stores, and then I got really anxious.
Now, how much soul searching do you have to do, or, you know, heart to hearts with people? I mean, you're not only being candid about your life, but plenty of other people's lives, the Macaulay's lives, mm-hmm. and your sister and brother's lives, and your mother's life, and your wife's life, and your son's life. And was there a tendency to want to protect it all, or did you just, if it came to your mind, you put it to paper?
Well, there are certain things that I just wouldn't put in the book, that they were just too raw, or I felt that it just wouldn't be fair to write about.
Yeah.
So I did get, you know, a lot of people said the book was very frank and very honest, and it was, but there were certain issues that I just felt were unnecessary for me to reveal, you know,
yeah.
for the sake of other people. So you do kind of always sort of tread a slippery slope of trying to tell a real story that has power and honesty and isn't devoid of blemishes, right? But at the same time, you know, there are certain things that you have to respect, or certain things that you would give away that would just be too hard for one of the characters to live through.
So right.
It is a balancing act.
Now, you come across as someone who feels confident as a songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's true. I mean, I think because I've written songs for so long, you know, that it just comes from doing it since I was 14. So that being said, whenever I write a song, you know, I'm just doing everything I can to make it as good as I can, and I go through a lot of rewrites, and I'm usually writing with a lot of writers that have had more hits than I've had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're chock full of writers my age in Nashville that have had 20, 30, 40 hits.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm confident, but at the same time, I'm always curious to make it better and anxious to see, to learn stuff. You know, I'm always learning. You know, yeah, you never want to stop in any facet of your life at any age. The curiosity has to always be there.
Now, that said, do those skills and does that confidence translate at all when you come to writing a book?
Well, I'm not as confident as a prose writer. There's absolutely not, simply because I haven't done it all my life. I certainly had a gift for prose writing as a youngster, and I was getting articles published, and I had to make a decision. I felt as a teenager to make a choice that I felt that it was a world of specialization, and if you wanted to have a chance at having international success, you know, it's sort of like you can't be a 100-meter sprinter and a marathoner.
Yeah, right?
You have to
right.
choose.
Yeah.
And so I felt that I had to choose, and I chose music. And so then when I started writing this book after my father died, which was partly because he died and I missed him so much that I needed to fill the void of losing him with the pages in this book, I wasn't as confident. But the great thing was that the more I wrote, the easier it got, and the more confident I became, and the more the words, especially since it took 3.5 years, I could feel the growth of my prose writing over that time.
the chapters sort of read like songs, like they're individual stories.
Well, that's really insightful because, you know, I think one of the things I was thinking of as I was writing is I've been trained to always be aware. Now it's unconscious. I'm not even aware thinking of it, but of keeping the listener's attention. You know, when you're writing a song, you know, when you're telling a story, even if we're sitting around telling a story, there's that mechanism, like, how do I keep your attention?
Right.
You know, what do I have to do? You know, and so that's been sort of indelibly imprinted into my brain that even as I was writing the book, there was an unconscious part of me that always knew I had to not lose the reader, that I had to keep their attention.
And it also reads like a Quentin Tarantino movie. Like, the it's not chronological.
No, I wanted to... I've always enjoyed structural games, you know. Again, songwriting is all about structure. You know, when to modulate, when to cut out a verse, when to go to the bridge. Do you go to a verse after the bridge? You know, structure is so important. In a three-minute song for a hit, you cannot make any mistakes.
Yeah.
You know, you can make a mistake in a great 800-page book, and the reader will stay with you if it's a great story and you really write well.
Mm-hmm.
Not so with a three-minute song. You cannot blow it one time. And I thought the idea of the parallel lives of my father as a child and me as a child going back and forth would be fascinating, because my belief is that really nothing really changes, that every generation sort of thinks that they're the first generation to feel all these things, to feel angst, to feel rebellion, to feel alienation, to feel like they can change the world. And as I dug into my father's life and his father's life, I realized that we were all the same, you know, that we all feel these longings to have our parents' approval, this fear that we won't live up to our parents' expectation, that we won't be able to slide into their footsteps. And in a way, that was a very beautiful discovery for me, to realize that we're all really the same.
You know? Right. Now, did you write it chronologically, or did you just, there was something on your mind and you wrote about that, and then something else was on your mind and you wrote about that, and you decided you'd worry about how you laid it out afterwards?
I had a pretty good idea of the structure from the onset. You know, I felt that in order to write a book, for me not to be defeated by the marathon task of a book, you know, that I had to have a fairly good idea of where I was going, mm-hmm. what I wanted to do. So I did have a pretty good idea of the structure of the alternating chapters and of moving forward in time with certain dramatic cuts back and forth, you know, for effect.
Now, speaking of for effect, I mean, your first chapter, it's 1969, you're a teenager. I mean, just conflict with your dad, genitalia, you know, all, you know, teenage angst, right? I mean, did you pick that? Did you think that'll draw them in, that'll get
well,
their attention?
Well, I thought, because so much of the story was the battle of control between my father and myself. He always wanted to control me, and I always wanted to resist his control.
Right.
And I really thought that was the perfect example of a battle of control, you know. And also it really showed kind of how unusual my father was, in a sense, even though it's a universal story. How many kids are actually being punished for, quote-unquote, not masturbating?
Because
you know, essentially that's what he was saying, is if you don't deliver this sperm sample, all your privileges are going to be cut off and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, sure, there's a certain part of me that's a dramatist, you know, that comes from my family heritage, you know, because my dad was a very dramatic storyteller, and my grandfather, as a Methodist minister, would tell stories. So I knew it was there was a little bit of, what's the word? There was discussion, you know, amongst the publishers about whether this was just too far out, you know, to start with.
Yeah,
I said, man, you got to take a chance. You know, I mean, there's just so many books and so many records and so many songs, and there's like, you've got to be bold. You know, you can't be afraid.
Yeah, in this day and age, you can't wait for people to warm up to where you want to get to.
and I felt it was emotionally true, because it really did very neatly kind of sum up this dynamic, this push-pull struggle between my father and myself, and yet at the same time, looking back at it now, it wasn't particularly funny when it was happening. But but looking back at it, I felt I could write about it with a certain degree of humor, you know.
And I thought it was a great way to start, and I thought it really did. You know, it could have been like the preview to the movie. I mean, it really did sort of set the stage for what the book was going to be about. Now, were you looking for catharsis or answers, or did you get out of the book what you set out to accomplish in writing the book?
Yes, I did, and more, you know, actually, because I had never read my dad's letters.
Right.
You know,
right.
Again, because of his work as the ombudsman and starting the Human Rights Commission, he had donated all his letters to the National and Provincial Archives.
Right.
And so after he died, I went through all his letters, and there were probably about 1,000. You know, he came out of the era of letter writing.
Yeah.
So I had letters from when he was 6 to when he was 76.
Yeah.
And the things I discovered in those letters, I had no idea. It's like we all have different sides. As my dad quoted the psychologist as saying, a man has as many selves as he has situations.
Yeah.
And certainly as parents, you know, there are certain things that we don't have to tell our kids, and it's probably better that we don't. You know, why tell them? You know, what's the point? I mean, what's the reason, you know? But it was like, man, peeling back an onion, I just found more and more layers. And so the father that I knew, you know, was this strong, powerful, charismatic, you know, highly capable, accomplished person, was so different than this insecure, you know, unconfident adolescent who wasn't sure if he could make... If he could stand up intellectually to the pressures of the black middle class, with that pressure that you had to really be smart and really achieve in order to, you know, overcome prejudice. And I had no idea he was such a wild child, you know.
Right, exactly.
I had no idea that he was with a group called the Red Wine Boys, and they used to drink themselves silly, and he would show up hungover for work or not show up at all.
Yeah.
This was not the kind of stuff my father told me. And so, and you know, and then I would interview people, you know, that grew up with my father, and I would find out more and more stuff. So in a sense, the wonderful thing about this book is it just got bigger for me.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know the story about my great-great-grandmother being raped working in the White House.
Yeah, that was a dramatic story.
Didn't know that till I started writing the book. So it was like getting on this train, you know, and the train just started going faster and faster, and it just sort of swept me along. And by doing that, by seeing my father's vulnerable side, you know, it was like he was taking the words right out of my diary or my son's diary.
Yeah.
When he was saying, I'm fast becoming a man and I still don't know my place. Or the way he said it was just so touching, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and how he would open his heart to his father and mother about his insecurities. And the more tender and vulnerable and insecure he revealed himself to be through his letters, the more I loved him.
Yeah.
You know, actually. Although I always loved him in life.
Yeah.
So it was a very, very profound experience for me. And it was like going into this brain-expanding chamber for 3.5 years.
Yeah.
You know, and it's funny because when I finished writing the book, suddenly I found that I could argue better, I could express myself better, I could write better. And I always thought it was pretty articulate before that, but something happened when I wrote that book. Something changed in my brain. It was just like this incredible growth of understanding of human nature, you know, that, you know, even if the book had never been published, to me it was one of the greatest things I could do to expand my own mind and my own heart.
Just the exercise of creating it. Now, you've got all of these chapters of your life that you can look back now because you've put them down on paper. What would you alter or change if you had a second chance?
Well, I'm not one of those people that really believes in that. You know, they say that, I think it was David Gilmore said this during a book reading I did with him, that pain is the greatest informer, that you learn from your mistakes. And that I'm not saying I'm a successful person, but the most successful people make the most mistakes. The guys that are hitting the most home runs strike out the most. I've made a lot of mistakes. But, you know, on the heel of those mistakes, you know, I learned some very valuable life lessons, and I tried not to make the same mistakes twice. So, to be honest, there's nothing I can really say that I changed, which isn't to say that I don't think I've led a perfect life. I've made a lot of mistakes, and I'm a very flawed guy, you know. But it's all part of the human experience, and it's I would rather kind of look at the now and try to become better at who I am and at what I do and how I relate to people, rather than look back at stuff that I've done that I can't change. You know,
right.
To me, that's if you've ever been to an AA meeting, which I've been to accompanying a friend, because I've never, you know, ostensibly been an alcoholic, that's one of the first things they say, is you can't change yesterday. You know, don't beat yourself up over what you've already done. It's about the now. You know, right. What are you going to do now?
Now, just to take one situation in your life where you were sort of ambushed by the three Bernies, mm-hmm. and sort of
yes.
were in a situation with, you know, your devotion to the Macaulays, Matt and his family, mm-hmm. and they seem to be the voice of reason. Like, what would you do differently now? Like, just knowing what you know, like faced with that situation.
Well, I would have stayed with the Macaulays.
Yeah, you
know, I wouldn't have broken my contract.
Yeah,
you know. But then, 55 is a lot different than 24.
Yeah,
know? And at 24, I was obsessed with success. And I was also more easily manipulated and intimidated,
yeah.
you know, by people that I thought were in power. Mm-hmm. So all that being said, I was a grown man, and I stand by my decisions as my own decisions, and I
right.
don't blame anybody but myself.
Yeah, you took complete responsibility yourself.
But sure, that's a very good question. If I was in that situation again now, I believe loyalty is one of the most important and most underrated qualities, you know. That's one great thing that my dad showed us, is that despite the various issues my mom had with her mental health, her mental emotional health, you know, he may have been tough in a lot of ways, but he was unbelievably loyal.
Right.
You know, he never ever, you know, when my mom was sick in the hospital, every day he would go see her after work. Mm-hmm. You know, he would come home, braid my sister's hair, make sure that my brother and I had done our homework and had cooked the dinner. And then he would go to the hospital with flowers, with chocolates, with letters. You know, that was the way a man was supposed to be. He didn't say this is the way a man behaves, but we learn from example
yeah.
that you do not run from adversity. If the woman that you love is in trouble, you don't suddenly say, oh, well, there's a better one over here. You stand by your woman, you know, to take that country song and turn it on its heels. You
yeah.
stand by your family. And so the same goes with loyalty with people in the business. Now, the people that I work with, I really, really love. I only work with people that I really, really connect with. And I love my creative friends. I feel really, really privileged to work with them. And I think one of the greatest parts of my life has been that my success as a songwriter or singer has opened this world where I've worked with and lived with these fascinating, brilliant people. I mean, I've been working with brilliant people since 1975, and what a great experience to be sitting across from Donna Summer like this.
Yeah.
And she just starts singing.
Yeah.
You know, there's when a person can really sing, like George Benson or Donna Summer, George
yeah.
Benson, they actually sing better than you realize on a record. Obviously, there's the other case, too, where
yeah.
people sound good on record and they don't sound good live. But the real singers sound better. When you're right in the room with them and you're hearing them in full three-dimension without a mic, without any processing, it's absolutely mind-blowing.
Yeah.
And so there was a part of me, if I was hanging out with Tina Turner or, you know, working with Celine Dion, you know, or working with Keith Stegall, who's probably written more hit songs in country than anybody in the world, that I just feel unbelievably fortunate.
Yeah.
I still can't believe that they would include me in their world. I
yeah.
always think that's because I'm a good storyteller, you know, that I make them laugh, so that's why they hang out with me. You know, I still can't believe it's because of my talent.
Now, let's just look at that situation, because that probably was one of those turning points in the book where you could have had your cake and eat it too. You were presented with an all or nothing proposition, which didn't have to be that way. And you didn't have the experience or knowledge or training to even prepare yourself for so many of these, you know, conflicts that you came up with in the music business. Should there be more transparency in the music business? If I want to sell you mutual funds, I've got to make all these disclosures to you, and you've got to sign all these waivers, and you've got to understand the risk you're taking. Even when you buy a lottery ticket, it gives you the odds
sure,
in the back.
Sure.
You know, just putting on your sage hat for a moment
mm-hmm.
And looking back over your career and all the other people who the music business didn't turn out to be what they thought it would be,
mm-hmm.
Should there or could there be more transparency in people entering the music business?
Yes. Yeah, I think there should be. I kind of think of the music business as sort of a frontier society. I kind of think of it as the way we would imagine the Wild West,
mm-hmm.
you know, where everyone kind of goes by their own rules,
right.
you know, and lives off their wits. You know, it isn't, you know, there are a lot of systemic problems in the music business when it comes to the business of music. And from my experience, it's it's a very, very difficult business and very, very easy to get ripped off.
Yeah.
And there definitely should be more transparency. It's unlike any other facet of the entertainment business in terms of there is more transparency in all the other entertainment factions. Like the book business is totally different than the music business.
Right.
As is the movie business.
Yeah. But yeah, for whatever reason, people take advantage of the artist's will to succeed is so great that they're susceptible to believing whatever you tell
them.
And
the artists usually start, you know, having a traction in the music business when they're young.
Yeah.
And when you're young, you're not really thinking about money.
Right.
Whereas authors, my brother, for example, he didn't really hit it out of the park till he was like 50.
Yeah.
And so when you're 50, you know, you're a lot more careful about the contracts you sign than when you're like 18.
Right?
I mean, John Lennon, when he was 17, he wrote a letter to his friend saying, "It's too late for me. I'm too old."
Yeah.
You know, you have to make it at 17 or you don't have a chance.
Yeah.
So I think part of it is that when you're younger, you don't think so much about money. You're more easily influenced and you're just so caught up in the music. And sometimes you think it's cool not to think about money. You think it's almost like a sellout.
Right, exactly. I'm an artist. I'm not a businessman.
Yeah, we don't deal with those sort of unseemly, oily things like money.
Yeah, yeah. There's always people to take care of
that. Yeah.
But, you know, it's a business and an art form, and people, I don't think, are properly prepared for
that. No, they're absolutely not. And the other thing is that the average pop career lasts maybe 3 years.
Right.
So, you know, then it's suddenly you're 25 and you're going, what happened? It's over.
Yeah, it's
shorter
than a football.
So you really want to be able to maximize the money that you're making in those 3 years.
How different would things be for you starting out now in this day and age? I mean, you've been through several decades of the music business, and the 80s were way different than the 60s,
mm-hmm.
And the paradigm now is way different than it was whenever the peak was.
Well,
how would your career be different if you were starting
that's
now?
That's a really good question, and it's really, you know, you can really ask anybody from various eras how, you know, I came of age in the golden age of singer-songwriters.
Right.
You know, so really, to be honest, the time was perfect for me. You know, it was wide open. You know, well, there were a lot of record companies. The economy was good. There weren't a lot of other entertainment factions competing for the teenage dollar.
Mm-hmm.
There were no videos or DVDs or Facebooks or computers.
Right.
You know, you made your 20 bucks babysitting or something. You went out and it wasn't 20 back then, but you went out and you bought an album, right?
Yeah.
You didn't have to think, well, no, maybe I'll buy this thing for my computer, or, you know, maybe I'll buy this new video, Xbox, whatever. So I think it was a lot easier in certain respects. That being said, it's much more of a global community now, so it's easier for Canadians, if they're lucky enough to make it, to make it around the world. You know, whereas in the 70s, there were all sorts of singer-songwriters that were doing really, really well in Canada that were not really getting outside of Canada, like, say, Valdi or Murray McLaughlin, or even to a certain extent, Bruce Coburn. You know, it was hard to break out of Canada in the 70s, but it was easier to make a living.
Just, right.
You know, to break into the record business was easier.
Yeah.
And to make a living selling 50,000 records was fine, whereas now, you know, because of the cost of marketing, making a video, all that kind of stuff, you've got to sell a lot. On the other hand, what's really interesting is that a lot of the great singer-songwriters are in country music. I mean, for example, Zach Brown, who my friend and co-writer Keith Stegall discovered, you know, when Zach was in college.
Yeah.
And he just won Best New Male Artist Grammy. He was up for a Record of the Year.
Right.
Now, Zach is really a singer-songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, to call him country is simply just a marketing title.
Yeah.
You know, so Brad Paisley is a singer-songwriter. When I listen to Brad Paisley, I think about Jackson Brown, you know. Same with Kenny Chesney. I'm not saying he's doing his own songs, but all of those songs are written by guys like me, you know, that came of age in the 70s, that made their own records, and they moved to Nashville, you know. So my guess is that if I was 20 now with the talent that I had, that I'd be in Nashville, you know. And they might be calling me a country singer in the same way that they called Darius Rucker a country singer.
Right.
But really, he was with Hootie and the Blowfish. I mean, is he really a country singer?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, these are all just sort of like, these are all almost like labels that are, you know, what's the word? You know, almost superficial labels that people need, but really Darius Rucker isn't a country singer.
Well, they used to be more defined lines, right?
Yeah.
Like if you were a rocker, you'd be kicked out of the club for going and seeing a singer-songwriter or to a punk show.
Yeah, Johnny Cash, Waylon Jennings, they were real country singers.
You know?
The Rolling Stones, though they started in blues, were thought of as a rock band. Yeah. So you're absolutely right.
Yeah, now it's, just some of the genres that don't make any sense. You know, like pop punk.
Well, there's so many genres and then subgenres. It's like alternative AC, and there's this LC and triple X AC, and you know, when we were growing up, or when I was growing up, you know, you could hear Earth, Wind, and Fire and Cat Stevens and Marvin Gaye and Gordon Lightfoot, and there weren't all these delineations. It was just, you know, it was just good music. You know.
Well, your book certainly tells a story of, you know, sort of the father-son experience, but also for anyone getting started in the music business, they owe it to themselves to learn a little bit about the history of the music business. And it kind of is a Bernstein Bears, this is what you should not do, so let this be a lesson to you book.
Right, that's funny. Yeah, well, it's true that it is instructive insofar as it follows my career trajectory, which, as I point out in the book, is really, you know, when you're living it, you think everything you're doing is so unique and special, and you don't realize that you're really just following this kind of pattern that so many other people follow, you know, that it is really, you're not as unique as you think you are in terms of your rise and fall and rise again. And for that alone, I think the book is interesting because it's very honest in how it chronicles how a pop singer can rise and fall. It also, I think, kind of deconstructs a lot of the mechanism behind songwriting, you know, which I think is a lot of people don't really understand.
It really is enlightening that way. I mean, understanding the life of a song in terms of, I think people have this idea that two people sit by the piano and put a song together and next week it's on the radio and, you know, the story of the Celine Dion song, and then someone else was going to release it.
In England, yeah.
And just having to go over there and just, you didn't know what to do, so you just leveled with them, said, look, if you release this, which you have the right to do, I'm finished in terms of, Celine. Yeah. And he just said, well, I'd probably ask the same of you, so yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. And it just... that was one of those lucky breaks.
I was lucky.
Your book had plenty of bad breaks too. There was one thing in here I just wanted to ask you about. Must have been reading it. God knows what time of day it was, but it really was quite profound. You're talking about running over to your parents' house, and of course, you kept all of your Junos and awards over there, and it said, I'd never felt comfortable keeping all those awards at my home. Bad luck. But even here, my gaudy career showpieces felt out of place, as if they belonged to someone who no longer existed or who never really existed in the first place. Childhood memories intermingled with pop star memories as the cold currents from the air conditioning vents pressed my sweaty... soaked t-shirt into my chest, causing me to shiver. So you describe yourself or your persona as like you were questioning, did that person even exist? Was I just pretending? Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, it's just sort of, it's almost like, you know, when you're looking back at your career, it almost seems like you're trying to remember a movie. You know, it was just moving so fast. And you're just so inside, it's like being inside a spaceship. You know, literally, as I explained, I'd be opening up to Art Garfunkel on the weekends, then doing my own shows during the week in America, and then on a 4 or 5 days off, I'd be Concorded to England.
Yeah.
And I'd be storming the media and doing Top of the Pops in England, only to take the Concorde back in time to, you know, get to New York, to then fly to Cleveland to be on stage to open up for Art Garfunkel. And it was like, bam, bam, bam. You're just moving so fast, doing 300 shows a year, and having to write more songs and record more songs, and... it was like being almost in this parallel universe, you know. And then all of a sudden, boom, it's over.
Yeah.
And so you kind of feel like, did that really happen?
You know?
you're 25 and you're thought of as a has-been at 25 when most people have really barely even started their careers.
Yeah, well, you were talking about you and your dad both being retired.
Yeah, at the same time. And so there was just kind of this feeling of unreality, like maybe it didn't happen.
Yeah.
Maybe those aren't my records. Or if they are, what does it mean? What does it matter? Are they mocking me? I think we tend to go through this. We all go through this with our lives. We look back and say, what was that? Was that high school? Did I really go to high school?
Yeah.
Am I still in high school? And you have dreams that you're in high school and you're failing the exam or you're naked in class.
You
know what I mean?
That David Byrne experience. This is not my beautiful home. This is not my beautiful wife.
Exactly. Exactly.
You get caught up in it.
Mm-hmm.
So you ended up making a new record. How long had it been between records of your original
work? I'd say about 16 years, 15, 16.
Because you'd made a decision that you were a songwriter now. You were not a performer.
Yeah. But what I was doing is, even though I was just a songwriter, I had to record all the songs in order for the artist to hear them. Mm-hmm. And they were really... It was like, essentially I was making records, but selling them to singers rather than selling them through record stores. So what happened is when I finished the book and I started doing readings, I would sing songs in between the little snapshots of the stories. And people responded so powerfully to the combination of the book and the music that I'd forgotten how much fun it was, frankly. And my old producers from the 70s were so moved by the book and the song I Am My Father's Son, the demo that they'd heard, that they persuaded me to make a record. And the funny thing was that it was the easiest record I'd ever made, because we just got together a bunch of guys my age who've been writing songs and making music all their lives, as I've been, some of whom I'd known for over 30 years. And we just recorded the record in like about a month. The hardest part was just choosing the songs, because I'd had about 60 songs that had been covered over those 15 years to choose from. I knew if we chose the right songs, and if I did my homework and really sang them and relearned them, because a song like, say, I Promise You for the Backstreet Boys, I wrote it on that piano, demoed it, and then forgot about it. Or I Do Cherish You, I wrote it with Keith one day in Nassau, then forgot about it. So I had to kind of learn how to sing these songs and find my own voice.
Right, because the song you heard over and over again was their interpretation of your original demo, right?
Yeah, it was weird. It's like, it's life imitating art, because they're hearing my demo, then they're doing their version. Then what's happening is I'm hearing three or four versions sometimes of the same song. I'm going and listening to this. I'm listening to Mark Wills singing the country version of I Do, then 98 Degrees, then my version, then Keith's version. It was sort of fun in a way.
Yeah.
But the other thing that was great is that these musicians, some of them had won Grammys as songwriters. And I toured with them back in the 70s.
Yeah.
The drummer had played with everyone from Shania Twain to Sting to Mark Knopfler to George Strait. Mm-hmm. So we were all kind of like peers. I couldn't pull any kind of celebrity act on these guys, because they played with way bigger stars than I could ever be. It was just a bunch of guys just loving music, And I think that was the most beautiful part of it, is I was really just trying to go for live vocals, and I was just saying, look, if you guys can keep playing this song, I'll just sit here and sing it as long as you can play it. We're just one. There's no hierarchy here, We're all the same age. We've all come from the same place. Let's just have fun and make the best music we can and not even think about whether people are going to like it or not.
Have you been conflicted? I'm sure there have been some pressures about touring it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have been touring. I'm not like going back to back day to day, but for example, on the 18th tomorrow I play Peterborough, and the 23rd I play the ROM. Then I do two benefit concerts on the 25th. I played London and Guelph, and I enjoy it, because really, it to me, again, it's just storytelling. I sit at the piano and I tell a story about how I wrote a song, and then I just go into the song, and then I jump to guitar.
Nice.
And often I have Liz Rodriguez perform with me, and she's one of my oldest and dearest friends, and she co-wrote the song on the latest Celine Dion Greatest Hits record, and she co-wrote a song that's on Pitbull's new record and is out as a single, and she's singing. So she's incredibly spectacularly gifted, and no one knows who she is, and she lives in Toronto, and she's managed by the Celine Dion group, and she can sing magnificently.
Yeah.
So I love that too, that I can, in the same way that I, sort of knew all about Celine before anyone else did, that I can take these little surprises and spring them on people.
Yeah.
It's exciting for me.
Yeah, that's half the fun of it, isn't it?
Yeah, and she has such energy, and she's so and has such a diversity. I mean, she'll write with me, and then she'll write with Dr. Dre. Then she'll be working with Eminem. Then she'll be working with Celine. I mean, that's pretty diverse. You know, that's pretty wild for a Toronto person born and raised in the mean streets of Portugal. Toronto's a little Portugal, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And so I like it because, you know, she keeps me fresh. You know, she has a whole different frame of reference than I have. And so I learn from her and she learns from me.
Now, you got a lot of your schooling on urban music from your son, right? From
David. Yes. Well, the ultimate urban music I got from my dad.
Yeah.
You know,
wow.
Meaning yeah. The those great jazz singers like Billie Holiday.
Yeah.
Who are the ultimate urban singers, in my opinion, you know, or Joe Williams or Ray Charles, you know, or Count Basie or Duke Ellington. But certainly I learned a lot about hip-hop and rap from my son, who really knows an awful lot about it.
Yeah.
And then, because I work out 2 hours a day, most of the time I spend watching BET, mm-hmm. Black Entertainment TV. So
yeah.
I tend to really like, you know, I like what I like and I don't like what I don't like, but I'm always drawn to the song. So,
yeah.
You know, if Lil Wayne has a great song, I love it.
Yeah.
You know, if Keisha Cole, who's a magnificent singer, has a great R&B ballad, I blast it. Same with Kanye, same with Jay-Z.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, if the songs are good, I like them. I don't care if it's Kanye West or if it's Brad Paisley. I'm just going for the song.
Well, that is one of the, I mean, lots of people talk about the glory days of the music world, but the mixture of songs that can be on somebody's iPod now are really quite dramatic
compared
to what they
yeah.
used to be. Now, our audience, IndieCan listeners, you know, might be, you know, brand new to, you know, Dan Hill, the singer-songwriter. Can you just pick a record off of Intimate, pick a song,
mm-hmm.
Give us the backstory, and we'll play it.
Okay, let me see now. I Do Cherish You.
Okay.
Okay. Keith Stegall and I had already written a song for Mark Wills called She's in Love, which is also on this album, that everybody thought was a hit at Mercury Records. But they felt they needed a first single, something that would just explode off the album and immediately get them on radio. And so Keith said, well, you got to come to Nassau with me, and well, he had a place there, and help me write the first single for Mark Wills. And I said, well, I don't really write like that. You know, I don't intentionally go out to write hits. I just write. He said, just get to Nassau. Quit complaining. You know? And we spent 7 days there and wrote 7 songs in 7 days. And the 7th song was I Do. And he dropped this great musical hook on me in the semblance of a chorus, and I had to fill it all in. And I thought, Keith, you're doing this on purpose. You tested me for the first week to see if I deserve getting. There's no way you're holding the best idea back for the end. You were trying to see if I was good enough. And it was me just being typically insecure. He said, no, I just came up with the idea this morning. So he said, but I'm leaving for Nashville later today, so you got to get this finished. So I felt this unbelievable pressure, like I'd never be able to nail it, and I sensed it was a hit on a platter that I just had to finish. So I finished the song in my apartment, went upstairs. He said, yeah, that's really, really good. That's a hit. And so then I went home to here, and I demoed it in my studio downstairs.
Yeah.
Sent it to Nashville, sent it to Keith, and never heard anything for 2 weeks. I thought, oh, God, they hate it. You know, yeah. They hate my demo. I said, finally, I called, said, what's going on with that song? Well, it's already on the radio. Mark Wills has already cut it. It's already put out. It's going
wow.
to number one. So there's, and then 98 Degrees heard it, because it was part of the same Universal Motown family. You
mm-hmm.
know, Mark Wills over here on Universal, 98 Degrees on Motown, Universal. 98 Degrees heard it, and then they cut it, and it became a huge hit all over again. So there's just one example of, you know. But the thing is, the important lesson here is we had to write 7 songs to get to I Do.
Yeah.
You know, and we were just holed up in his apartment with a guitar and piano. We had nothing else, nothing fancy. It was just our guitars and our melodies and our ideas. And I always think if we had drum machines and synthesizers and beatboxes, we would have got around to writing the songs. We'd have been fuddling around with all the production.
Right. Well, that is a great story.
Thank you.
Because it, yeah, I mean, it, you know, it's like an overnight sensation can take 25 years.
Yes.
Right?
You know? Absolutely.
And that was the, you know, culmination of years and years of work. You also tell a similar story about your very first co-writing experience where you felt you were expected to create on the spot, which just wasn't your style. I mean, you could, when you were on the road or in your youth as a songwriter, just spit them out, boom, boom, boom. But, you know, that was by yourself and only for yourself. And that was a pretty intimidating experience for you the first time you had to co-write, wasn't it?
Well, yes, because I came of age listening to the likes of Lightfoot and Joni Mitchell and Neil Young, Dylan, and they all wrote by themselves. Now, that being said, the Beatles clearly collaborated, and I love the Beatles too. But you know, I was 22, I was cocky, I'd had two gold albums already in Canada, and the idea that someone was telling me I should write with someone else, I took it to be an insult.
Yeah.
Because I was 22 and cocky, and at that age you think you know everything. And so I got together with Barry Mann, and I had this notion that you can only write under, you know, the throes of powerful inspiration. In my case, as I say in the book, it was usually sexual torture someone was putting me through. Then I would write. And Barry was just like banging out idea after idea after idea on the piano, expecting me just out of nowhere to come up with these words. And it was just antithetical to anything I'd learned about songwriting. So as a defense, because I couldn't write that way, I didn't have the training at 22, I just said, here's a lyric. I didn't want to tell him I'd actually written a whole song called Sometimes When We Touch, because I was afraid he'd think it was a cast-off. So I just pretended I'd written this poem, and I just handed it to him. Went outside the little piano hovel room to call for a cab, and he'd already written the chorus to the lyric by the time I made contact with the cab. And he said, you got to hear this. And he goes, sometimes when we touch, and he's just playing me this.
Yeah.
It was that fast.
Yeah, that is a great story. And I got 100 other things to ask. Maybe we'll do it another time.
It would be my pleasure.
Because you've been very generous with your time, well, Dan Hill.
And you with yours, much. Both of you. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. Thanks.
Thanks. That was fun.
All I am, all I'll be, everything in this world, all that I'll ever need, is in your eyes, shining in me. When you smile, I can feel all my passion unfolding. Your hand brushes mine, and 1,000 sensations seduce me, 'cause I do cherish you for the rest of my life. You don't have to think twice. I will love you still from the depths of my soul. It's beyond my control. I've waited so long to say this to you. If you're asking, do I love you this much? I do. In my world, before you, I lived outside my emotions. Didn't know where I was going till that day. How you opened my life to a new paradise. In a world torn by change, still with all my heart, till my dying day, I do cherish you for the rest of my life. You don't have to think twice. I will love you still, I'll always love you from the depths of my soul. It's beyond my control. I've waited so long to say this to you. If you're asking, do I love you this much? You know I do. Oh. If you're asking, do I love you this much? I do.